In this part of Focus 580, we will be inviting your questions about cosmetic surgery. And our guest for the program is Dr. G.D. Castillo. He is a cosmetic surgeon here with a practice in our area. He's been on the program before to talk about this topic, and it's one of the things that are on our list of health subjects that we like to deal with now and again. It's your opportunity to call in and ask questions about some of the most common popular procedures that are done these days. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you for inviting me again.
It seems that every year the number of people who are having procedures or actually also the number of procedures, and maybe that also means the number of people, seems to be getting more and more every year, and probably also the number of men having cosmetic work done continues to grow.
It is true. In fact, when I began my practice some 30 years ago, cosmetic surgery was something that you really didn't speak freely about. It was a little bit of a taboo. It has changed dramatically. Most everyone today knows someone, whether it is in their family or a friend, who has had cosmetic surgery. And many people entertain the idea today. So the focus of what was and what is today, it's very different.
I think probably lay people tend to use the words plastic surgery and cosmetic surgery interchangeably, and I think probably for people in the field, they do make a distinction between those two words. What's the difference as far as you're concerned?
Well, the practice of plastic surgery consists of both cosmetic and reconstructive work. Mm-hmm. And really, what we refer to when we talk about plastic surgery most commonly is cosmetic surgery. Reconstructive surgery is part of plastic surgery, but it certainly the idea of reconstructive surgery is so different than mm-hmm. cosmetic surgery that today I would say that most general plastic surgeons and specialty plastic surgeons are referring to their practices as a cosmetic plastic surgery practice if they do cosmetic surgery, and some of them avoid cosmetic surgery altogether, and they call themselves and refer to their practices as a reconstructive plastic surgery.
Hmm. So in one case, you might, for example, might be dealing with someone who had some sort of serious injury and that you were trying to help them have an appearance that was more like what their appearance was before. And in the other case, it's people who are, well, it's more of an aesthetic issue perhaps for them. That is, there's something about their appearance they would like to change or improve. And so for that reason, it's a completely elective kind of procedure.
It is. And the two are so different from one another. Mm-hmm. Plastic surgery really involves procedures in all of the body parts, whether it be hand surgery, whether it be burn surgery, reconstructive surgery from an accident. So that is quite different from someone who may be just trying to improve their appearance and the way they feel about themselves. Mm-hmm. That is really cosmetic surgery and the focus of some people's practices.
Mm. Well, we said that one of the things that we could do was talk a little bit about some of the most common, most popular procedures. But before we started here, you said that now there are people, when they come to see you, there is more interest in procedures that are less invasive, more easier things that can be done to improve their appearance. What sort of things here are we talking about?
Well, it's true. You know, human nature being what it is, we're interested in procedures that are not going to take us away from our daily life, that maybe do not expose us to any cutting or any of the things that we perceive as being invasive and so forth. If to that you add the emphasis that manufacturers have on the media today, they can flood the media with a new product and make a niche segment for their services. Like, for example, we're talking about Botox. We've been using Botox for many, many years. Certainly 25 years ago, we used to use Botox, and some of the uses were cosmetic in nature, but there was very little known about Botox. today the manufacturers place a huge media campaign, and all of a sudden everyone is aware of it, and it becomes much more popular. Now, some of those manufacturers, I think, push their products a little bit beyond what they really can do. And sometimes we have people coming in with unrealistic expectations as to what an injection can really do for them. Certainly, you cannot take 20, 30 years out of somebody's face with an injection. But there is a big interest from people in all kinds of injectables, not only Botox, which is a way of reducing the function of a muscle, but fillers as well, which, for example, we have hyaluronic acid, we have methylmethacrylate, some products that can be injected into wrinkles that can remove some of the signs of aging with nothing other than an office visit, no downtime, no waiting for the result. The result is immediate.
So, and what we're talking about here is a variety of things that are designed to deal with wrinkles and make the skin appear to be smoother, and then also make people look more youthful, right?
It is. And also, if we think about what happens to a face as we age, you know, we think of fat as being our enemy because I guess we all fight it. But as we age, we lose some of the fat in our faces, and our faces become stigmatized as to age because there is a certain amount of a cadaver type of a look, particularly if you look at the later years in life. And if we add fat to a face, we can renew some of those youthful characteristics that the face had before. So not only are we talking about implantables that may be naturally occurring in nature, but sometimes we can take your own tissue, that is your own fat, move it from a place you don't want it to a place that is wanted or needed, and improve the result. Here you're not really dealing with wrinkles, but you are using it as a true filler, as a means of restoring that those curvaceous looks on a face that call to the youthfulness that has been lost through the ages.
Where on the face are there particular places that you would be most likely to be doing that, and where would they be?
Right. The places that we have some interest in injecting fat because they renew some of that, some of those curves that we talked about, would be the cheekbones, for example, would be the cheek area, and that is the area just below the cheekbones where we tend to lose some of that maybe baby face look where that is lost. And those are the principal areas around the eyes. You can remove some of the bossing of the bone in the forehead, the area just above the brow that tends to give you a severe appearance or an appearance of aging. Again, small amounts of fat in there. Sometimes if the eye tends to recede and become old-looking, you can inject fat around the eyelids. That also gives you significant youthfulness. Mm.
How long is a procedure like that good for? And eventually, will the effects diminish?
Yes. Fat, some of the fat becomes absorbed and it's gone within probably a month or 2 months. But I would say from the fat that you inject, properly injected, you can keep 30% of that fat pretty much for good, and it's going to stay there pretty much forever. Mm-hmm. The fat can be stored, and in fact, when we remove fat, we put it in the freezer, a deep freezer, and we can re-inject it in the future. The take, that is how much of it stays in the patient in the second injection, once the fat has been frozen, is less than the procedure done with fresh fat, but it can be reutilized
So you might, if you really wanted to have a stable result, you might have to have a series of treatments over a period of maybe, 9 months or a year?
Well, it is. I think we tend to discard a fat after 4 to 6 months max, just because there's a problem with storage, number one. And number two is we really don't know how long you can really keep a fat in a frozen state. And what I mean by that is we know you can keep it forever, but how long is it going to really be useful? But you try to get your best result during the fresh injection. And then if there are small areas that need a little bit of tinkering with, then you can use that frozen fat that you have had there in the future. And it gives you a very reasonable result.
So I suppose it's important that indeed it be like anything else, that it if you're going to put it back into that person, it should have come from that person in the first place.
Oh, absolutely, that you have no problems of rejection, allergies, or anything like that when you're using your own tissue.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, this part of Focus 580, Dr. G.D. Castillo. He's a plastic and cosmetic surgeon here in our area. I mean, that's what we're talking about, cosmetic surgery. And if you have questions, you can call in and talk with him, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Certainly, Botox is something that's gotten a lot of attention in popular media, and I think everybody probably has heard about it, but may not be sure exactly what it is that it does, and might also be a little put up by the fact that they may understand that what we're talking about is a toxin that under other circumstances would be harmful, that we are deliberately introducing into the body because of what it can do. What is it, first of all, that the effective agent that you're using?
Yes, Botox is a botulinum toxin, and as you refer to, it is a toxin. It is it's deadly. However, when it is used in the medical means that we utilize it, it has been attenuated, and that means that the toxin has been made so weak that it is impossible for it to produce illness as we know it, as botulinum intoxication, but it is delivered to us in a sterile container. It's frozen, and it is extremely delicate. So when you prepare it, you prepare it with a saline solution that has absolutely no preservatives, no alcohol, no nothing, because anything that you add to it can kill the toxin and make it totally useless. When you prepare it, and instead of shaking the bottle that it comes in, you very gently roll it to allow for some gentleness so that it's not really bothered. So it is a very weak toxin. What it does is it prevents the transfer of function between the nerve endings and the muscle, what's called a neuromuscular plate. And in preventing that transfer or making it so much more difficult, then you weaken the muscle structure. And so many of the unwanted features in the face that we have them because we smile, we frown, we make faces that if we were looking in the mirror, maybe we wouldn't, but we don't look in the mirror when we speak, so we tend to make all kinds of faces. So it prevents those unwanted animations of the face that give you the wrinkles and the frowns and so on.
Hmm. If you already have those wrinkles, is this something that it's supposed to prevent future wrinkling, or if you already have some wrinkles that you're concerned about, will that do anything about them?
It does pretty much both of them. I think immediately when you inject a botulinum toxin, what's going to happen is that over a period of maybe 2 to 4 days, nothing's going to happen. And then in about 4 days, you're going to see that you don't have the wrinkle anymore, or it's diminished considerably. And that is because the muscle has, over a period of days, become a little more difficult in creating its normal contractions. Well, if you continue that for a period of months, then the normal creasing of the skin that goes along in making that wrinkle when you, in essence, are removing some of the dermal cells out of the skin, that wrinkle becomes less and less visible. So over a period of months and maybe two or three injections of Botox, you can get rid of the wrinkle sometimes in a fairly permanent basis, as long as you either re-educate your face not to make the movements that you used to make before, or continue with the botulinum injection. I guess the main problem of botulinum injections is not the result. Everybody loves the results. The main problem is that the result is not permanent, so you have to go back 3 to 4 months later and have a second injection.
Mm-hmm. But you had said that this is something, the botulinum toxin is something that in cosmetic surgery has been used for a long time. So we do have it's been used for a long enough period of time so that you can say that there's, as far as we know, there's no risks of its use over a long period of time?
That is correct. Many years ago, we're talking about maybe 25 years ago or longer, we used to use Botox in facial tics, in what's called hemifacial spasm, when mm-hmm. people have those very, very unsighty spasms of part of the facial musculature. And there what you did was you prevented those from happening. We still use those today, but it not only has that application been around for many, many years, but there are other illnesses like some of the muscular dystrophies that are related to abnormal movements or contraction of muscle structures in legs and other areas. They are currently being treated with massive doses of botulinum toxin with fairly good results and with really no side effects. It has been fairly side effect free. There has mm-hmm. been an incident of an allergic reaction or a reaction to botulinum, which was not properly treated, but it, for the most part, it has been fairly effective and free of problems.
Mm. And if you did a number of injections, so say over a period of time, then I guess my question would be: was that in time, will that interfere with the normal function of that muscle that you're working on, or I mean, would you get to a point where it wouldn't work like it used to, or if you stopped the treatment and enough time passed, then it would go back to the way that it was before you started?
I think it would be the second one that you've mentioned. What you're really trying to accomplish is the re-education of your facial movements. Mm-hmm. You can certainly speak to people without making that big frown. And that's part of re-educating your facial movements. You can certainly smile without really creating all of those wrinkles within your eyes. But again, it requires a reconstruction of your thoughts as to what your face should be like in motion. And I think that to many of us is very interesting to see our faces when someone takes a picture, because sometimes you don't recognize yourself. Oh, I didn't know I'd make those faces when I'm smiling or when I'm talking. So for
Botox, are there particular places on the face that are the most common places that you would put it?
They are, and those are the frown area, the forehead, and crow's feet, which is really the entire area surrounding the eye. We can do it as well within the mouth. It's not as effective within the lip area. It's not as effective. And within some of the lines of the neck, where you tend to have some banding of the neck, mm-hmm. pretty effective there as well.
Mm-hmm. What sort of restrictions or requirements are there on people who would offer this kind of treatment? Is this something that can only be offered by physicians, or are there other people who are doing it?
Currently is something that is only done by physicians, and most injections should probably be done only by physicians, because obviously your main problem is that someone may have a simple what's referred to as a syncope, which is your concern as a person about an injection. You tend to pass out, so to speak. Mm. And if you do nothing other than lay this person down, that person is going to be okay. But if you leave them in a sitting position or a standing position, they are going to convulse. They are going to have problems. So you need some medical background as to what to do with someone who may have a simple problem, as simple as passing out in your chair. So I don't think that Botox will ever be the type of thing that you can go to the salon, have your hair done, and have some Botox injected at the same time. Unless something really changes, I think Botox will remain in the province of physicians mostly.
Yeah. And as this is an elective kind of procedure, I wonder, can you give sort of a rough figure? I'm sure that it's different from physician to physician. What a treatment with Botox would cost?
Yes. One area of the face, one or two areas, like, for example, the frown area and the eyes, you can do with 18 units, which would go for about $280. Three areas you can do with about 33 units, which would go for about $390. And that's what most people would have done.
Mm-hmm. What, just going back to the kind of procedure that we were talking about before, which would involve in literally injecting some fat, some of the person's own fat that you remove from them, to in a sense fill in the kind of places on the face that tend to hollow out,
right,
as one ages. Relatively speaking, again, what are the costs of a procedure like that?
The harvesting of the fat, the freezing, the injection, would be about $1,500. And then if you needed a re-injection, the only thing that is charged is an injecting fee, which is, we just get your fat out of the freezer and inject it, and that is $75 for the injection.
Mm-hmm. Are there any insurance plans that would pay for this, or is this always something that that people have to pay for out of their own pocket?
I don't know if any insurance that today covers cosmetic surgery. There are a couple of procedures that are covered through insurance plans, and one would be nasal surgery that it's related to maybe both a deformity but also a function problem, like the nasal septum is or the nose is preventing some of the normal respirations. That would be covered through insurance. Breast reduction would be covered through insurance because large breasts tend to decrease your level of activity and interfere with your exercise, work, etc. So generally for an insurance to cover you, you must have two things happen. Number one is you must have a problem, and there are a lot of problems. But number two is that problem must cause some function deficit. So if there is a deficit in function, then the insurance will cover you. Otherwise, no.
Yeah. We're about halfway through this part of Focus 580, and would certainly, if people who are listening have questions, you are welcome to call. We'd like to talk with our guest, Dr. G.D. Castillo. He's a cosmetic surgeon here with a practice in our area, and I'm sure he would do his best to answer your questions on any of the kinds of procedures that we've talked about or anything else that falls within this area. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I have been looking at the website of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, and it looks like, from what they say, that the among the top surgical cosmetic procedures performed last year were a liposuction. They say that's number two. It's the nose. Rhinoplasty would be the first one. The second one would be liposuction, breast augmentation, eyelid surgery, and facelift. Those are their top fives. I want to talk maybe a little bit about liposuction. Again, this is one of those things that people have heard about, and I think that they know what it is, although the idea of it still seems kind of hard to picture, because what it is it's literally, it's removing fat, it's vacuuming out fat. There are definitely limitations on what you can do with this procedure. It's not a way that people overall can deal with weight, but if there are specific places that are a real problem, and I'm sure that probably the abdominal regions are the big ones that people are concerned about, it is a way to deal with a problem that you can't deal with any other way, apparently, that you can't exercise away, that you can't diet away. Let's talk a little bit about the procedure, and particularly what it is that it can can do and can't do.
All right. Well, with liposuction, you have the best candidate, and the best candidate would be that person who looks in a mirror and they say, gee, I look pretty good, except I have a bulge here on my lobe handles, or I have a problem with fat on my lateral thigh, the so-called saddlebags. That's a very best candidate. Someone who is in their normal weight and who just has bulges, excellent candidate for liposuction. However, not by any means, most of the patients that we do are not the best candidates because we live in a society that we have today in which a great number of people are overweight. So many of the procedures that we do today are people who are above their normal weight but who can be improved through the removal of sometimes large amount of fatty tissue. And liposuction has been improved and perfected to the extent that you can remove safely on an outpatient basis up to maybe 2 gallons of fat. And that is a very, very substantial amount of fatty tissue. Mm-hmm. You can accomplish some really phenomenal things on someone when you remove anywhere between 1 gallon to 2 gallons of fat on an outpatient basis in a safe manner. Now, the patient who is definitely not a good candidate for cosmetic surgery is someone who is obese. I mean, if you really don't, if you go beyond the term of being maybe overweight to obese, then you are not a candidate for liposuction by any means.
So you said you could remove up to 2 gallons of fatty tissue. Is that all at one time, or do you have to do that in installments?
That is all at one time.
Wow.
Yes. And it's got to do with the improvements in technique, the use of ultrasound, the use of the tumescent technique, good anesthesia, good hydration, and proper preparation of the patient prior to surgery. And operating in healthy individuals. If you meet all of those requirements, I think you can do fairly safe procedures with minimal problems and with good results.
And this does require a person to be completely anesthetized?
It doesn't, but it is in their best interest many, many times to be anesthetized because liposuction is a physical procedure. So it's something that you probably want to be out. You don't really want to know that someone is physically removing some fat out of you. It's not a simple thing as just taking a vacuum and suction it out. Mm-hmm. It's the actual pretty much sculpting of an area, and you sculpt it through many strokes of those cannulas. So.
And what sort of recovery time are you talking about? Particularly if you're doing something that much, I would think that probably the person post-operative would for some time experience some discomfort.
And they do. There is some pain after liposuction, and it depends on the areas. Usually, if those areas that we sculpt are areas that do not move continuously, like the abdomen or maybe the breast on a male, you can go about your business immediately with very, very little problem. But on the other hand, if it's done on the thighs, on the buttock, on areas that really have flexion movements, then there is some pain, and there is pain for about 4 days or so. Most of our patients go back to their work within 4 to 5 days after surgery with very, very few limitations.
Well, we have some callers here to talk with. Let's do that. We'll start. We have someone on a cell phone. We'll start right there, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I had a couple of questions about liposuction, and then, of course, I'll hang up and listen. The first was, if you were specifically interested in getting fat removed from your abdomen area, what would the cost be? Is it sort of per gallon or pound, or is it just do you look at the person and decide, okay, this is how this procedure is going to go, et cetera, and this is how much it would cost? And then my second question was, I am overweight. I have been most of my life, but I've always been very physically active. I swim, I do martial arts, et cetera, et cetera. And only recently, as I have gotten older, have I developed an abdomen. And so I'm curious as to whether or not I would still be a candidate, even though I've been overweight. Thank you. I'll hang up.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, a couple of points there. Point number one is do we do liposculpture on someone who's overweight? And the answer is yes, we do, because a lot of our patients are, and they are good candidates for it. It has to do with family traits. There are some families that tend to have deposits of fat in certain areas of their body, and you can't help it once you get into the 20s, 30s, 40s. The accumulation of fat is going to be there. Insofar as the cost, one of the things that some people tend to forget is that when they say, I have some fat in my abdomen, what they are also saying, it goes all around me. It goes into the waist area, and it goes into the hip area, and that's the back of the abdominal area. So that what we have is we have a circumferential problem. We have a problem that goes 360 degrees, and that changes the scope of the surgery. And what that means is that we need to turn that patient under anesthesia and do both front and back. That is the only way of really getting a good result. In fact, the difference between liposuction and liposculpture is that liposculpture is 360-degree sculpting of an area in the abdomen. It would consist of sculpting also the waist and the back area. So in someone in which we're going to do just the abdomen, and that would not be most of the times a person who is overweight, but if someone would just have the abdomen and we want to do it under a local anesthetic, we're probably talking about maybe $2,500. But if we're looking at doing a circumferential liposculpture, now we're looking at more like maybe $3,500, $3,900 of total costs. When you put the anesthetist and the operating room and the bills and the pre-op care and post-op and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go next to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, you alluded to my question in a previous statement, but I'm interested in a little more detail. I read somewhere that about liposuction being a less invasive way of doing a breast reduction for women. You mentioned it for men, and I'm wondering if you could give me a little more detail about that as a method of doing a breast reduction for women.
Yes, liposuction is a pretty successful way of reducing the size of a breast. During a breast reduction, you're going to do two things, and that is on a classic breast reduction. You are going to reduce the size of the breast, number one, and number two, you are going to lift the nipple areolar area so that the breast is more youthful. Now, that is carried out with the surgical procedure. With liposuction, you can reduce the size of the breast and accomplish a very small amount of elevation of the nipple areolar complex. That is the drawback of liposculpture as to breast reduction. How much can you reduce a breast with liposculpture? It depends on the ratio of fat to glandular tissue. Most breasts will have at least a 50-50 fat glandular tissue. And if that is the case, you could reduce the breast by 50% through liposculpture with a fairly minimally invasive, I would say, procedure as compared to and also less cost as compared to a standard breast reduction.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, to the next caller, this would be Normal, line number four. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call, mm-hmm. Doctor. I'm calling about a procedure I saw on Oprah, which I know is kind of silly, but it was a Hollywood dermatologist, and she was talking about people who are having the same problem I am, where right under my chin, it's kind of saggy, and the lower part of my cheek is beginning to crease. And she showed a machine that looked to me like a Doppler, and she said it was cold, I remember that, and that you apply this to the face in about a half an hour treatment. And then 2 or 3 months later, the skin builds up collagen underneath and plumps out or firms up. Can you tell me anything about that?
Well, I can give you some general answers that have to deal with your problem and with what you saw. First, there is a great deal of tissue relaxation that happens when we get into our 40s and 50s. And that tissue relaxation has two origins. One is the skin becomes a little lax, less fibers, less elastic fibers. And two, we tend to get more fat in those areas, which tends to weigh the skin down. And that gives us a double chin, number one. And number two, gives us jowling. Those two problems can easily be taken care of by neck and facial liposculpture, which is a minimally invasive procedure. Good results, and it has been referred to as a weekend facelift, meaning that you can have it done on a Friday and go back to work on a Monday. So that is a normal treatment for the double chin and jowls. Now, there have been a number of techniques that have been explored in the media mostly, but that have not survived to peer review. Peer review is when a number of physicians are going to try this technique and are going to say, yes, it is effective, or no, it's not effective.
I see.
And those techniques have to do with, for example, ultrasonic liposculpture to the area without really making any kind of incision. So you are
right.
Really putting an ultrasonic cannula or probe on the tissue and attempt to tighten the tissue.
I think that's probably what I saw.
For the most part, it really doesn't work. I mean, generally, okay. If it's too good to be true, it isn't really.
Right. And how much would the liposuction to the neck area run approximately?
The total cost for that procedure would be $2,400.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And we'll continue.
Bye-bye.
The next caller here is back in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if you might say something about voice. Many years ago, I visited with you. I had lost my voice to nodules on vocal cords, and you'd taken me through to the process of going to Burnham Hospital to have the nodules removed, and you looked down my throat and said, this has improved so much, the operation has relatively low prognosis, so why don't we leave it? And I was very grateful for that caution. And many years later, I found out that I had allergies which had a relationship to the nodules. And I've learned how to not violate my voice and have lived with it, and I still haven't had to be operated on. And I very much appreciated that, and I thought that you perhaps could tell others that that is an aspect of your work that doesn't come out as cosmetic, although it has a very cosmetic aspect.
I'm so happy that you haven't had any problems, and don't we all wish that we could take care of problems by just redirecting our lives in one way or another? I think that's wonderful.
Is this a common thing for you to be handling?
No, it isn't. We don't deal with voice and voice problems, although, in fact, I guess one of the areas in which we age is our voice as well. And as we grow older, we can all tell who is older because their voice tends to get a little raspy, a little bit more weak and so forth. And there are procedures that can be done to improve the voice, and those are done today as we speak.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your caution.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580 with Dr. G.D. Castillo. He's a cosmetic surgeon from our area here. And if you have questions, call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mentioned a little bit earlier that breast augmentation, meaning enlargement, was one of the top five procedures, cosmetic procedures that are done in this country. And I think people will recall not very many years ago, but a few years ago, there was a lot of concern about the implant that was used, the ones that had silicone. What now are you using? Was it right to be concerned about the silicone breast implant? Or was there some feeling afterwards that perhaps maybe it wasn't it causing as many problems as we had thought?
Well, that's a very interesting question in the sense that breast implants were approved for their use without really having a manufacturer submit the breast implants through a very rigorous procedure in which you're going to answer all of the questions that are related to a breast implant before you're given that opportunity to use it on a human being. That was not done with breast implants. They were grandfathered in through the FDA law, so when they became devices, became something that you would need approval for. So we knew very little about breast implants. And silicone breast implants were created by making a shell by a process of actually drying some of this silicone polymer and then filling it with the same silicone. Now, in hindsight, it seems pretty logical that if you're going to put a filler on something which is made of the same material, that the filler may in time dissolve that material. And that is exactly what happened. The silicone dissolved the shell that the silicone was contained, and we found a lot of those prostheses non-existent anymore. Now, it did not create a problem in the sense that your body is going to make a capsule, that is, a shell that covers that silicone, and in so doing, it's going to contain it and it's not going to go anyplace unless that capsule, your own tissue, ruptures, in which case some of the silicone may leak out, and if it does, your body is going to again contain it by making another capsule. So in answer to your question, were those concerns valid? I guess they were valid in the sense that we did not have the data to back up the use of silicone prostheses. On the other hand, they were not valid in the sense that a congressional panel and institutions with a great deal of respect in the scientific community like Harvard and Mayo Clinic created studies, were longitudinal studies in which these people were evaluated, and they found that silicone prostheses were actually quite safe. The whole lawsuit was dismissed by the Judge Poynter in Georgia. And in fact, we have been using silicone prostheses since 1992, but in a manner in which we are reporting absolutely every detail of their use to the FDA. There are people who have been designated investigators for the FDA and can use silicone prostheses. Our office is one of those. In that respect, their use has been uninterrupted. We are the only country in the world that does not use silicone prostheses. So I think that it is safe to say that at some point, silicone prostheses will become used more widely in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Today, however, 95% of our prostheses are saline. The saline is obviously the same thing as you inject in an intravenous solution, but the shell of that saline prosthesis is a polymer of silicone, which is contained in all of the injectable or all of the implantable materials like pacemakers and total knees and shunts and so forth. So it's a fairly safe implantable.
Yeah, because you do use silicone in cosmetic procedures other places. Chins, for example, you use.
That is correct. We use them on the chin. We use them as cheek implants. It has been used in other areas like pectoral implants for males, calf implants for male and females. So it's used fairly widely with a solid silicone rather than a gel.
So that's the issue. It's the form of the silicone. If you're using solid silicone, there's no concern about it deteriorating and possibly going where you don't want it to go.
And I think that is a very good way of putting it, David. I think what happens is that silicone and silicone polymers have been used. They occur widely in nature. And what happens is that in a solid form, they are fairly stable in a liquid form. They may not be. And some of the implantables today, for example, the breast implants, are now cohesive silicone, which is a form of gel, but it's so cohesive that it does not migrate. It pretty much stays. It behaves as a solid. Mm. Those are the newer prostheses are cohesive implants.
We have maybe about 5 minutes left. We have another caller here to talk with in Munster, and that's on our toll-free line right here. Line four. Hello.
Hi. I was calling because I've noticed as I've gotten older, I've developed, like, my eyes, my eyelids have gotten very heavy. I don't know if it's an accumulation of fat or what it is that makes your eyes seem so heavy that they're almost pushing down on my eyelashes. And I was wondering what could be done about that and if it can be done under a local anesthetic instead of a general. And I'll listen off there. Thank you.
Okay.
I would presume that the caller is talking about the upper eyelids because you can have that heaviness in both upper and lower eyelids. In the lower eyelids, the problem is almost universally fatty tissue, and you remove that fatty tissue through one of many incisions. In the upper eyelids, it's a little bit different, and it can be caused by a heavy brow, and that is a drop of the entire forehead area. And that is corrected through a forehead lift, which can be carried out under a local anesthetic. Most definitely, the cause of most heaviness of the upper eyelids is relaxation of the skin of the eyelid. That is a simple procedure. It's called a blepharoplasty. It's done under a local anesthetic. It's a relatively simple procedure. It should cost $2,500 or so for total cost. And it's very successful in the sense that it removes the tissue and the cause of the wrinkles and the heaviness of the upper eyelid. It's widely done, and as you mentioned, it is one of the five most commonly done procedures in plastic surgery today.
And does that require a general anesthetic to do that?
No, it is a local anesthetic in most cases, and it's certainly a quick in-and-out procedure.
Just thinking about eyes, there are some people who have very dark areas underneath their eyes, and it seems in a lot of people to be something that is hereditary. It's something their parents had, their grandparents had, and it's sort of a thing that seems to run in families. Is that something that you can do something about?
In many instances, it is. It is, as you say, a genetic predisposition. The skin tends to be a little thicker. There tends to be some crepiness of the skin. And by changing the nature and the texture of the skin, you can get rid of some of that darkness. And you do that through a heavy peel, that is a phenol peel, or through most commonly in today's world, through laser resurfacing by removing the top layer of the skin and the top layer of the dermal skin through the laser. It tends to give you a smoother skin, which has a lighter color as well. So it is possible to remove it, not in 100% of people, but it's certainly in a good percentage of people.
Generally, what can you do with things like chemical peels or dermabrasion, the things that work on the very top layers of the skin of the face? What sort of things can you do with that?
Well, with microdermabrasion, which is really a non-invasive procedure, the only thing you're creating is an abrasion of the skin to where you have absolutely no problems. You can have it done and go back to work. Your skin may look a little reddish, but healthy red. And that can accomplish the removal of very fine wrinkles of the skin, the improvement of the texture of the skin, and also the improvement of the color of the skin, particularly some of the hyperpigmentation or the blotchiness of the skin. Chemical peels vary from very mild to very deep. With very mild peels, you can accomplish the same thing. With very deep peels, you can accomplish the removal of all wrinkles on the skin and very significant contracture, although the deep chemical peels also require an anesthetic for them and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there's a great variation in chemical peels from the very light ones to the very deep ones.
Well, there, we'll have to wrap it up because we've used our time. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Here. Thank you.
And Dr. G.D. Castillo, he's a cosmetic surgeon here with a practice in our area.